Thank you all for coming tonight. This is a forum, and our topic tonight is public discourse in this time in our nation's life. And the recording is on. If you have a distinctive voice that can be identified on a recording, you might want to tend yourself. Mary Schramm. I'm Martin Wells, and I'm glad to be with you tonight. My position is to go invisible. I first experienced the forum at Holden Village during John and Mary Schramm's years, and there was on the weekly faculty appointed someone who was called the village philosopher. And there was a lot of struggle. People really wanted that role because it sounded so important. But the village philosopher's main job, and I think I remember Michael Pellet doing it as well as anyone ever, because he was so bright, was to offer a couple of prompts for conversation and then turn the conversation to the room and see where things would go. And perhaps, if necessary, redirect things or recharge things at various points to see if something else might be stimulated. One of my favorite words these days is the word provocation, which is usually taken to be a negative term, but in fact means to call forth the vocation of others, to call it out and try and make room for it. And so this topic, public discourse in this time in our nation's life, maybe subtitled, How Do We Speak and Listen to One Another in Such Freighted Days? One older theory of that had to do with the beloved notion of the First Amendment, that the response to wrong speech was more speech. And now we have it in spades through social media of all kinds. I've lost my affection for the First Amendment, I think. Does anyone have a starting place? If not, I will try and start something. Let's start here. In your ELW, do you know that the small catechism is now in the back of the hymnal and available to you during those moments when you're challenged in church?
Sounds more like an advertisement, Mark.
Page 1161, the Eighth Commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. What is this? What does this mean? We are to fear and love God so that we do not tell lies about our neighbors, betray or slander them, or destroy their reputations. Instead, we are to come to their defense, speak well of them, and interpret everything they do in the best possible light.
Let's put that on the courthouse.
Anyone else struggle with that? Or French mystic Simone Weil says this: a hurtful act is the transference to others of the degradation which we bear in ourselves. That is why we are inclined to commit such acts as a way of deliverance.
Could you repeat that, please?
A hurtful act is the transference to others of the degradation we bear in ourselves. That is why we are inclined to commit such acts as a way of deliverance. So I was in a bit of road rage coming home from Pullman one night in a deep, dark night, and suddenly I realized that someone was following me too closely. And as it turned out, I had another driver who wanted to harass me, and I was terrified. I slowed down, they slowed down, I sped up, they sped up. I was being worked on, and it was working on me. I made it home safely. I opened the back door. I said, "Hello, I'm home." And not one of the three persons in the house said hello to me. And so I got furious. I was so mad. And it had nothing to do with my family, who, of course, loved me and had from three rooms away said hello. I just didn't hear it back. But I had delivered myself of the degradation that had been wrought on me by that other driver. And I delivered myself of it. If there had been a dog to kick, the dog would have been kicked.
Except that it didn't solve anything, did it? It really isn't a deliverance. I think that's a false metaphor.
I think you're wrong.
Speak up. So the connection, if you aren't making it yourself, is that I think we live in a time of deep and collective anxiety. We're living afraid a lot of the time. And I think we deliver ourselves of that fear by producing fear in others. And that's part of the loss of our capacity for conversation. What used to be called dialogue, two words, dialogue, is now making speeches in close proximity to one another. No interpenetration at all, no capacity to change the other. What keeps you from treating a neighbor, even a neighbor enemy, in a way that would interpret everything they do in the best possible light? What keeps you from that?
Mostly, I don't know my neighbors. There's more isolation than there is. The only communication we have is the signs that we put in our yards for candidates.
I'm less comfortable with being uncomfortable with those neighbors that I don't know very well.
I know I'm
pretty guilty. One of the things they talk about, that increasingly I live in a social world where almost everybody that I interact with reinforces my worldview. So mm-hmm. all my friends listen to NPR. I don't know many people very closely who start their day with Fox News or, you know, those different kinds of things. And so so it's really easy for me to adversaries in the abstract because I just don't know them as real people.
And I live in a completely opposite situation. With a community of 150. We live on an island. And we have learned to agree to disagree if that's what we need to do, but we still have to keep respect for each other because we need each other.
Is that a satisfactory accommodation to reality? Does it work for you?
It does work. But we've been at it for a long time. And then there are certain people you talk to about things like politics, and there are others you don't talk to people about at all. You avoid it. Avoidance.
Do you think that the people that love what Trump says are like you coming home at night being upset about things and just not being able to say it, and somebody stands up and says, you know, this isn't working, I'm mad, then we've got to change this. It seems like he is being a spokesman for what many people are feeling, the rage they're feeling. I mean, that's pretty obvious for me, what you said. But.
And we have a flood of new books attempting to describe that anger and that sense of having been left behind. Hillbilly Elegy, one of them.
I'm kind of perplexed at the lack of concern that I hear about the rhetoric against people of Mexican origin. I mean, I've known several, and I've never met one that I didn't like, that wasn't very sociable. And yet they're being portrayed the other way around, and I don't understand why people don't just stand up and say, how can you possibly say these things about these people? Perplexed.
But this is happening in more places than just our own country. As well, I mean, the things that we are witnessing and in the treatment of refugees and in Europe, the rise of the extreme right in many countries in Europe, the Brexit vote, there seems to be the rage and the fear of the other that is so apparent in this country seems to be more widespread than just our country, and I find that very disturbing.
As a young person, I wonder if that fear of the other has to do something with coming closer to the other. With the advent of globalization and technology and social media platforms, where all of a sudden those people who could comfortably sit in another region or another country are right in front of you on your screen.
We don't quite know what to do with that critical distance that a screen creates, but it still has the capacity to stir us pretty significantly, doesn't it? Yeah.
Back to the small catechism. Part of the difficulty in not putting best construction on certain people we take, political opponents, for example, is that they are so obviously and so loudly not putting the best construction on us. And so it becomes a kind of a cycle that of verbal violence that is difficult to break. You say, well, I'll put the best construction on you, but you got to put the best construction on me also. And that's not happening. becomes like a cycle of ever more negative.
Sometimes I fear being played the fool, that I just wasn't shrewd enough to know what was actually happening.
And what does that do to you inside?
It's what was the word that you used before? The
degradation.
The degradation, yeah. Yeah. I think like I wasn't smart enough or bright enough. Or so it's a protection of self to just maybe not slander, but also not put the best construction.
Could that have something to do with the social isolation that Susan is talking about? That it's just not worth the risk of knowing a neighbor? It's just more comfortable to cocoon inside four walls?
Could be, yeah. Because I know the other thing is then having something asked of me that I'd really rather not do, but I really wouldn't easily be able to say, well, no, because.
I sometimes wonder if we are just plain afraid to talk to other people. I mean, I'm not a Lutheran, but I've discussed, you know, Lutheranism with my Lutheran wife. I've discussed Hinduism with a Hindu. I've discussed Buddhism with a Buddhist. It doesn't mean you're going to go to hell if you talk to these people. They have reasons for being what they are, you know, for following the traditions that they are. I was even surprised that a well-educated Hindu had a very reasonable explanation of what they believe at the core of their belief. I was surprised at that. But I could sit there and say, well, yeah, that's similar to what I believe in many respects. But you know, why are we afraid to talk to people? That's what it looks like to me.
I'm not afraid to talk to people. I'm afraid to listen to some of them because I don't think I can control my anger.
Do you know where the anger comes from?
Yeah. Well, I just don't agree on any level, on a very basic level. And if it really cuts into something that I hold strongly as my values, it's difficult for me to listen and not react in unhelpful ways.
So one choice would be to isolate.
Just don't get into
it. Just stay out of it, yeah.
No, Martin. Some of us watched this movie, Return of a River, about the Elwha. And if I understand the story right, this group of citizens began to meet and discuss the possibility of removing this dam on the river. And if I've got it right, the majority of them were against the possibility that that could happen. And they were somehow in a room together, and I don't know over how much time, but they listened to other people and they listened to one another. And they not only changed their minds, but they came to consensus. I would just love to know what all happened in that group. Citizens with different points of view, different things at stake, differing values, changed their minds, heard one another, came to consensus. I sat here and thought what did they do? That seems almost unheard of in public discourse, which that was, I guess.
Does anyone know more about that process and how that came about? David?
No. She summarized it quite well, but I don't know how long a period that happened. That was early in our time of living in Port Angeles, and we weren't kind of keyed into the process at the time. Just read about it in the paper, and that's too long ago for me to remember how long it took. But it was miraculous. in a sense, that minds were changed by data delivered from neutral sources, and then coming to consensus, because there were a couple of fringe people involved in the process. So,
anyone remember when data used to make a difference?
Martin, I know part of my problem is I just feel such a qualitative difference this election. I'm not on the progressive side of the Democratic Party, but I can sort of, at this point, even understand Reagan, and I can understand Bush, and can see arguments that people can make. And when I look at what Donald Trump stands for, I'm not talking about supporters, but what he stands for and what he said, I just see a lot of evil. And it's significantly different for me than other past political candidates with whom I disagree. So then I'm in a whole nother realm of, you know, wanting what he stands for to, you know, rot and sheol. And so it takes me out of the loop of conversation, really, because if it were another kind of Republican with different ideas, I could disagree and have some conversation, but I'm seeing what I see as a representative of evil, and I don't know that that's good, but that's what I see. And I jump ahead to what comes after that, if that person prevails. So that blocks off for me a whole avenue of conversation that I might have been able to have 10 years ago with another candidate.
See, are we supposed to listen to people that are just wrong? And
so how do we put the best construction on a bully without appearing to accept the bully's point of view or argument? Might be to try to put the best construction on what I sometimes share with Tom, that feeling of outrage. How do we put the best construction on the in our conversation with a bully without baptizing that bully's behavior?
The problem is I agree with that, but I'm not going to have a chance to talk to Donald Trump. What I'm going to have to talk to is my brother-in-law who supports Donald Trump, you know? And so, back to you, Red. You know, it's not just how do you talk
to my cousin.
Yeah, so how do you...
All my cousins.
Yeah, and so the real question is on how do we talk with the bully? How do we talk with the people who like the bully?
Support the bully.
Right?
Like the bully.
And that's really hard.
Yeah. I'm not saying I do this or do this well, but I've been really struck by, when I've taken the time to read carefully interviews of a wide variety of Donald Trump supporters, I sort of identify myself with the kind of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but there's a growing perception among a lot of particularly working class folks and white working class folks that the Democratic Party has been captured by elites. It doesn't listen to regular working class folks anymore. And so that's become a strong base of the Republican Party. And I think the Republican Party has, I think, frankly, they've created the atmosphere for many years now that produced a Donald Trump, because I think they've intentionally cultivated fear as the motivating thing. But on the other hand, the white working class in particular is really hit hard by the 2008 recession and really hasn't recovered. And I don't think they feel listened to. And I think they have legitimate concerns. I think Bernie Sanders was the one person in the Democratic Party who tried to listen to that and felt that. But so I think, you know, I don't agree with Donald Trump being an answer to that, but I think that the grievances they have are real. And they don't see a better future for their kids than they themselves have had. And they're living a harder future now than their parents had. And if you just listen to the way they talk, I think there's real concern there. So I'm concerned that politicians are not hearing that and responding in constructive ways.
I'd like to go back to the How Do You Talk to a Bully? It is actually a book that was published, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago called The General Art of Verbal Self-Defense, and it tells you how you can approach such a situation.
Do you remember more about that?
Well, essentially you drop into data mode. How do you know that what you're telling me has any real meaning? Now, demand actual facts.
But that doesn't seem to make any difference. Facts are not a part of this campaign at all. It's bullying lies and facts just... And the media has fueled it. The media has not held the candidate to being factual. They have been tried so hard to be neutral in their weighing the candidates that they have, in my opinion, failed to stand up for what's right and what is true and what is factual.
The last moderator of that National Security Forum, the
Matt Lauer.
Matt Lauer has taken a deep hit for that, isn't
he? And he should have.
Well, you know, it's rather a complex situation too, because it's not just the people who are unhappy because they lost their jobs. I think we're dealing with more than just the fact they lost their jobs. We're in the middle of a technology change, and those jobs, regardless of what we want, are not there. They've moved, they've changed, and bringing back work from overseas is still, the jobs still have changed. And so we've got a whole group of people who are totally disenfranchised. We don't have a good answer how to solve it. I don't think either candidate does.
Well, the gap between the 1% and those that are struggling is greater than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. I think that causes a mentality of scarcity, which can fuel fear and I don't have enough, or I might not have enough, so someone else is the problem, perhaps. We live in an area where there's a lot of Trump signs. And our neighbors, you know, we've dealt with some of that. Tom and I kind of, we had a 97-year-old neighbor that just recently passed away, new people who have been. She was fairly conservative, but neighbor came first, Murray. It was a way to kind of, you know, broach issues.
One way of interpreting this issue is that there are some people who are terrified that this world has become fundamentally inhospitable to them, and that they are simply left out, and they are going to be left behind, and others are getting in line before them. How do you talk to somebody who's terrified?
Well, especially if they don't acknowledge it, and instead it comes out like aggression or anger.
That ever happened to you?
Well, I'm thinking about my cousins, too. I mean, like, all of us seem to have these relatives somewhere. Mine just happened to be in Iowa, but not to get back on Iowa again. There's something about that.
But most of us learned at one point or another that fight or flee was always the option.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're both reactions to the same kind of thing.
But I mean, so sometimes you could say to someone who's acting aggressive or angry, "What are you afraid of?"
Yeah.
And see if they can actually touch down on that.
There was an interview of a coal miner only a few weeks ago, and I think he was expressing what you're saying in that he said, yes, we realize that what we are doing is damaging our planet, but what choice do we have? We have to feed our family.
Well, that was about the same time that all the coal miners found they had no retirement, and that was a dismal piece for them, that the company that they've worked for all this time has deserted them. They've all gone bankrupt.
And now they maybe have black lung and no health care.
Right. No wonder they're afraid.
I think the current climate has given permission for people to express their fear in ways that are basically, there is an air of incivility about conversation. And I think that because the rhetoric has been abusive and violent, it is giving permission for people to behave and speak in that way. So when the candidate says things that are just plain uncivil and cruel, he's cheered. And he's given permission then for others to behave similarly.
Wasn't there something ahead of that, though? This whole anonymity that the internet has allowed, and all these blog conversations and so forth, I'm sort of appalled to read the kind of, you know, they ask for comments, what people think it's okay to say. And once that becomes okay, then you've got another whole level of uncivility that's okay now to introduce into political discourse. And we seem to think this is normal. He's just saying what we've been saying.
I'm struck by the, I'm sort of a radio junkie, and an NPR junkie, basically, but if you roll the dial, all the other, most of the other media stations, it's not just being unkind, it's blaming. And from my point of view, the blame is being misplaced. But I don't know how you can help people to understand why they lost their jobs. I mean, it is the company who took away their benefits and their medical and so on. But it isn't Obama. you know, it's that sort of thing. But if you listen to the radio stations, they're blaming people who had, you know, not really a lot to do with it.
Well, and I wonder how much time is wasted in the perpetuation of that blame versus just trying to get down to the real issues. I mean, how much time are, you know, if I identify with the liberal group, how much time are we spending just tearing down Trump when we could actually be formulating and presenting viable alternatives and solutions to the people who are supporting him? To what extent are we just being bigoters ourselves and not actually addressing the issue?
Right. And this whole cycle of violent talk, I mean, I just, when Hillary thinks she has to return evil for evil, that just bugs me. Why can't she just accept what is said and, I mean, let it go. It's out there. You can't bring it back, but just don't repeat that same kind of behavior. If I was running for president, that's
say more about that strategy, though, because that's a different way of handling it rather than just firing back. You're saying, is it the same as absorbing?
Yes, I think it is.
Take the high road.
When they go low, you go high. I mean, that's what Michelle promised. Yeah.
Isn't there an even further step? If it's really fear that's behind it, it's very hard to confess fear. Don't we have to confess first before other people will feel that it's safe to confess? So it's very different if we start the unburdening and the opening and the vulnerability, and which is not exactly what you expect when you get attacked, but it may be the thing that disarms you.
So let me try and up the ante. Go back to Simone Weil and repeat her first statement and then add one. A hurtful act is the transference to others of the degradation which we bear in ourselves. That is why we're inclined to commit such acts as a way of deliverance. If someone does me an injury, I must desire that this injury does not degrade me. I must desire this out of love for him who inflicts it, in order that he may not really have done evil. If someone does me an injury, I must desire that this injury does not degrade me. I must desire this out of love for him who inflicts it, in order that he may not really have done evil.
That's a high moral ground.
Well, it makes me think of Barack Obama. I mean, seriously, what has not been slewn at him? What's the word? Slung at him. And he, I cannot believe how he has responded. Oftentimes, deflecting, absorbing, not really paying much attention to, or whatever it happens to be, and taking the high ground. And I don't think he's gotten a lot of credit for it, but I think it's been happening for many years now.
The New York Times had a very interesting take on the thing that irritated Mary, because people said Hillary slipped and just got into an angry mode talking about the followers of Trump. New York Times said she knew exactly what she was doing. She wanted publicity like he gets, and she got it. And so they praised her for it. Very interesting take in what the politics, what it takes in politics now for the media to cover you. That's part of our problem, I think.
We're living in a generation of reality TV, and that's what I think a lot of people are looking for.
I can't hear you.
More. Say more about that.
Reality TV.
I don't have more to say, but I just think I mean that's what's on. Is the reality TV? Yeah. We want drama. We want the conflict. We want the shallow dive.
I read somewhere that said that we all voted for Trump years ago.
Exactly.
When we turned toward media and that circus and
well, yeah, that the article talked about that we've kind of put Trump up many years ago through TV, that we got rid of programming that was educational, that gave us critical thinking, and it was replaced by nonsense.
The Kardashians.
Yeah, and nonsense stuff that the only way the networks would give us that is if people wanted it. So it was being pushed forward by, you know, people and men, and Trump knows how to play to that.
By saying you're fired.
Yeah, and Trump is a lot more interesting to watch for everybody than Hillary is boring.
We need to look at what happened in National Geographic. I mean, are you aware of what happened in National Geographic 2 months ago?
No.
Yes.
They were acquired by an Australian, Murdoch, and he fired all of their top executives.
The photographers.
And so, what are the news people themselves, what are they up against? A lot of them are in a similar situation.
Martin? So I was the one that blurted out about that false metaphor, but I'd only heard half of her story. Who is the author again? I can't hear. Simone?
Simone Weil.
Okay.
W-E-I-L.
Well, doesn't that
French mystic.
So, no. Isn't that exactly what we're called to do here? Yeah. Yeah. Is to take that on.
Well, that's where I was wondering if someone might start talking about Jesus or the cross.
I read a snippet of Bonhoeffer every morning, and it's always a struggle because that's not the theology I've been pickled in for a long time. But I can't get too uncomfortable, or I can't get too quick to turn the book off because I know where his life is headed. And so it's made me sick still with that a little longer.
How many hours was Larry Rasmussen grilled in this room about why Bonhoeffer did what he did? Yeah. The last piece from Simone Weil. It is the false God who changes suffering into violence. The true God changes violence into suffering.
So we get what we deserve, maybe?
It is the false God who changes suffering into violence. The true God changes violence into suffering.
Are we required to believe this?
I mean, I sense what Chuck and Peg and Wendy are getting at kind of goes along with maybe some biblical language, right? The idea of sin, the idea of personal deficiency, the idea of suffering, the idea of having voted with your ratings, you know, how you're clicking through the channels, right? I feel like with all of the language and the threads in this tapestry that we're trying to tie together can come together really nicely in the fact that we're uncomfortable with our own selves. Whether it is sin, or personal deficiency, or however you want to describe it, or suffering. The fact that we haven't acted to help out those people who are supporting her, or that we haven't acted to support our brothers and sisters who are of color and are being oppressed by the system, because we're afraid of recognizing that we ourselves have taken on that sin.
And Martin, it's so much easier to follow the false God. It's so much work to not let that pain get us. And I think that's so much of it. When we form our opinions of people, we're all intelligent people and our opinions were formed by our perceptions or something. We want to be right in that. And so we look for support of our perspective. And to look the other way and build them up, that's a lot of work. And so it's easier to find your dog to kick when you come home and you're angry than it is to take the time and maybe even talk it out or release it differently. Yeah.
Yeah. The anger goes with the flying dog.
Right.
Yeah. I think the challenge for me in my work in the last years has been to respond instead of to react. One more quote for you, just because I think it's so lovely and it gets at another dimension of this. This is a longer quote from Nell Morton in a 1977 essay, Beloved Image. It was reprinted in the book, The Journey is Home. It was in a small group of women who had come together to tell our own stories that I first received a totally new understanding of hearing and speaking. I remember well how one woman started, hesitating and awkward, trying to put the pieces of her life together. Finally, she said, I hurt all over. And she touched herself in various places as if feeling for the hurt before she added, but I don't know where to begin to cry. She talked on and on. Her story took on fantastic coherence. When she finally reached a point of most excruciating pain, no one moved, no one interrupted. Finally, she finished. After a silence, she looked from one woman to another. You heard me. You heard me all the way. I have a strange feeling you heard me before I started. You heard me to my own story. Morton says, I filed this experience away as something unique, but it happened again and again in other such small groups of women. It happened to me. Then I knew I had been experiencing something I had never experienced before, a complete reversal of the going logic in which someone speaks precisely so that more accurate hearing may take place. This woman was saying, and I had experienced, a depth hearing that takes place before the speaking, a hearing that is far more than acute listening, a hearing engaged by the whole body that evokes speech, a new creation. The woman had been heard into her own speech. How miraculous might it be if we could listen long enough and deeply enough for someone to finally get the bile out.
So would we ask someone who's been listened to in this way, in this very deep way, to be able to listen to Black Lives Matter? Would they be able to do that? Or would they get beyond their own hurt to see the hurt of the refugee or the immigrant or the...
I don't think we can ask anyone else to do the listening. I think the challenge is for us to ask, can I listen someone more deeply into a new moment.
But not having the expectations for their changes of action or thought or attitude.
Unless you're Simone Weil and you're trying to keep that one from actually doing evil.
Don't you respond to their agenda, not push yours? Mm-hmm. What is it that they're hurting about? Instead of what I think you should do and what you should be interested in, things I'm interested in. We have to just meet people where they are, where they're hurt. I find myself in an interesting position with four grandchildren who are going to vote for the first time. And I've been very hesitant to ask them what they're going to do. And I still am hesitant to ask them what they're going to do. But I'm going to before November, whatever it is, and try to do it in a way that will help them to see a world that's not very kind at the moment, to at least vote but please vote.
I was watching you.
This
Dan? Oh. And then let's see if there's someone who hasn't spoken yet who wants to finish up. Dan, and then Dorothy, and then Diane.
Well, I've been trying to think about in my own life where I've tried what you're talking about here, and actually has been a really rich experience. And I don't think it's changed voting patterns, but for 10 years, I've been taking students to meet with conservative ranchers who think the worst thing in the world is to be an environmentalist from the University of Montana in Missoula. the level of alienation between our rural ranches in Montana and how we're perceived in Missoula, and to say you're from the environmental studies program, I leave out the fact that I'm gay until I get to know them a few more years. Already enough of stuff on the table. We've been doing this for 10 years, and I just had it last weekend. Had another 15 students, and we're there, and we go out, and we spend an afternoon working with them on a project, and we have a barbecue, and they invite the other ranchers, have an evening together, we camp out on their land, and then we kind of move on. And we just listen. We just come to listen. They ask us questions too, but mostly we just listen. And I have to just narrate one thing, because a really extraordinary thing happened. I'll try and make this short, but about the second year I was doing this, we were listening to an older rancher who's in his early 70s, and he was an extraordinary person. He had graduated, his father died when he was 11. He took over the ranch when he was 12. He graduated from high school, but he put 6 brothers and sisters through college, but there was never money for him to go to college, and he had to run the ranch. So one of his regrets in life is he's in his 70s and he'd never gone to college, but he'd done all these other amazing things. Sarah, the student, when we got through listening, said, "We're gonna get him an honorary degree." And long story short, she worked for 2 years, and we got turned down several times, stuff, but we got the governor write a letter, we got all these people write letters, and long and short of it, he opened up his mail one day to find a letter from the University of Montana saying he was going to get an honorary doctorate. He thought it was an April Fool's joke doing that, but it ended up happening, and he ended up being the keynote speaker at our commencement in 2010, and what that did for our relationships, half of the ranching valley of his town came to the University of Montana for that commencement to honor him. And that was a breakthrough moment where we now have, I'm not saying we agree on everything like that, but we're at the point now, for example, when he was saying, "We have a problem now because there's too many elk on our land." And I said, "John, you just need some more wolves." if I had said that 10 years ago, I would have been escorted off the ranch at gunpoint. I mean, probably quite literally. We all laughed. We know we don't see eye to eye, but we have built this relationship over 10 years of just listening, and we've just built up trust. And so we don't agree on a lot of things, but we really love each other. And we have this relationship with several of the ranchers there, but it's taken 10 years as well. And that's the one part of my life, I think, where I've taken the time to really get to know other people on their terms, from their ranch, listen to their story. And it's transformational for our students. You know, it takes these issues that are conceptual and theoretical, and now we're people. And I don't know how we do that with the other parts of our lives, but I know that's what's worked in mine.
I like that last point, that somehow you didn't go to a neutral, fact-based argumentation to try and break it open. It was simply listening to another's life.
Well, there are two things I heard too. Is one is you don't need to just talk about the election. You know, but get on some other issue like schools or, you know, healthcare in general, which is upsetting for lots of people for different reasons. And then get on someone else's territory and actually put yourself in the position that Jesus and his followers often did, which was to accept hospitality from someone that you wouldn't normally hang out with.
Dorothy. Diane?
Well, I was eager to build on what Dan was saying, because I guess I was thinking, you know, what's my sphere of influence, you know, my neighborhood. And I'm thinking about two different neighbors, one that I've just given up on talking to, and I think they're mentally ill and, you know, all kinds of bad things, and so we just actually literally sort of made a fence.
actually
at the idea,
sort of made
at the,
a fence.
Well, it's a wire. But
it's a great
they, at the idea level, I think that we have more in common with each other at the idea level than a man who just recently died who I always said, you are my favorite Republican. Because we disagreed about most everything at some kind of idea level. But because of what the thing that Lola was saying, we had to work together on a committee, we wound up becoming the best of friends. And so there is something about creating real relationships that I think, at the beginning when it says, what about public discourse? I would say, what public discourse? We have very little public discourse. We have reaction to media. But in terms of really talking with other citizens of different opinions, we get that opportunity in jury duty. But we have very little contact out of our silos that's real. And some of that brought me back to a whole new thing about our morning Bible study with the familiar text from Matthew 25 about, you know, the cup of water and the cloth, the clothing, and so on. All of those things, whether you did it or you didn't, have to do with contact, real contact, and a response or lack of response. And I just think to whatever extent we can do things like you just described, Dan, to begin, initiate, create relationships with people that we initially judge to be so different, that's, in a sense, that's the least I can do. That's where I might have some influence, and
yeah.
Go ahead. Well, something that I heard with Dan's story too was just what is the agenda? The agenda, and Dan's is sort of a question for you, but was the purpose of what you did to build relationship, and or was it to try to change? I don't know, I feel like the anger comes from me when I have an expectation of needing something to shift or change or to convince, or and I think if the goal or the objective is to love or to understand or to deepen that listening, I don't know, I think there's something about, there's the Buddhist thought that the root of suffering is attaching to an outcome or a result. But in the conversations I have with my Republican Trump supporting family, I feel like if I listen without an expectation, I can breathe in it. But when I want to convince or want to pull the data out, so I struggle with the data versus, but I think there's something about, the mystery is somewhere where the expectation is, what's the purpose of the listening?
Krista Tippett calls it in her book Becoming Wise, gracious listening.
Mm.
That we all have to learn to be gracious listeners.
Gracious listening.
I'm so aware that we basically as a room made an assumption about the political and voting patterns of the people in this room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I were sitting here and were a Trump supporter, I'd wonder, could I talk to anybody in this room? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting to me what we did pretty quickly about making assumptions of being in a like-minded group. And what if we aren't? And how would we... we begin to mend.
We wouldn't open our mouth.
That's right.
Well, I think
we
it was,
agree, we wouldn't open our mouth.
I know.
I think it was Dan who said used to living in a pretty homogenous world. Well, all his peeps listen to NPR. I mean, so it's not too much different than that in a certain way.
That's, we're talking about the 150 villagers or everyone in the village right now.
Yeah. I'm glad you named that, Susan, because I thought that right away when we started it out. Someone should have jumped in there pretty fast.
So I'd like to add that it could also be true, how do we talk to people even when we agree with them? Mm-hmm. How do we talk about difficult issues?
Yeah.
I have spent most of my adult life in congregations that have learned behaviors around how to avoid talking about difficult issues. And I guess I think I would just say, whether we agree or not, well, what was the poet Antonio Machado? We make the road by walking.
I'm thinking of the Eighth Commandment right now.
Well, very
and
nice.
And how we...
Okay, I can stay there with you. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess we... And we should check one another, too, about whether we're slandering the other or even putting the best construction on the other or seeing the deep humanity and wounds of the other or even admitting the little pieces of ourselves that resonate with the other, but we would just be so embarrassed to say it out loud. You know what I mean? I mean, so maybe even in a place, if you were even around your dinner table with people you all knew were kind of on the same page, how do we learn with one, how do we teach our young and learn together to speak well of those who aren't in the room? That's a challenge for me. That's a challenge for me. That Eighth Commandment is a challenge for me.
Even if I like them.
Yeah. And I like you, Rick.
We all have our limitations.
All right, I'm probably speaking too much, but I like to see other people are in a similar place or a different place. I am approaching this election with dread and mm-hmm. sadness, and I will be terrified if one side wins, but even if the other side wins, I don't see any way that coming out of this election without our country being even further polarized. And I compare it to where it was 8 years ago with this sense of excitement and hope and things could change there. And I am aware that there is many people who say they will be distraught and terrified if Hillary wins, as there are who will say they'll be distraught and terrified as Trump wins. I mean, it's like over 80% of each side says that they can't imagine living in this country if the other side wins. And that's, for me, a really frightening place to be in as a country. So I know that part of what makes it difficult right now is I know I'm operating out a lot of fear, and I project that outward. It becomes anger, it becomes cynicism, it becomes dismissive comments. But I'm really, really scared about where we are as a country right now. Mm-hmm. And part of it's political fear. I really do fear that if Trump is elected, that could move to a demagoguery kind of thing. And I think democracies can be very fragile when they're under a lot of stress, and ours is under a lot of stress. But I also, if Hillary wins, I think we're also going to be in a really frightening place as a country. And what's frightening for me is I just don't see the groundwork being laid on either side for how we bring this country together following the election. Maybe I'm too pessimistic, but that's where I am coming from. I'm really frightened about where we are.
It broke open for me the other day when I heard a commentator suggest that we should have the option to vote neither of the above, and that if that vote prevailed, both candidates simply go away and you start over with the candidates. Down there.
Well, and the reality is, regardless of which one wins, we still have a Congress to deal with.
Right.
We're past our hour. Thank you very much for the kind attention and the good conversations. Go in peace.